brick to her feet, seeing her tucked up warmly on the sofa in the little parlour, with a pillow to her head and salts to her nose, a thick shawl round her knees. At last they were gone. She could be alone. And now that the truth was out in her own mind, she could cry for all her losses, for father and lover, family and mother, for the loss of time and place, and all that she should have been and would never be. Except that she couldn't. She tried. She tried to summon up the sense of terror she had felt in the drawing-room, alone among the crowd. But now that she truly was alone, paradoxically, she wasn't afraid any more. One of the house-slaves popped a head in, but she waved a hand, sending the girl away again. Well, she was Scottish too. Well, half, she muttered, cupping a hand over her belly, and entitled to her own stubbornness. They were coming back, all of them. Mother, father, Roger. If it felt as though that conviction were made of feathers rather than iron, still, it was hers. And she was hanging on to it like a raft until they pried her fingers off and let her sink. The door to the small parlour opened, silhouetting the tall, spare figure of Jocasta against the lighted hall. Brianna? The pale oval face turned unerringly toward the sofa. Did she only guess where they had put her, or could she hear Brianna breathing? I'm here, Aunt. Jocasta came into the room, followed by Lord John, with Ulysses bringing up the rear with a tea-tray. How are you, child? Had I best send for Dr. Fentiman? She frowned, laying a long hand across Brianna's forehead. No! Brianna had met Dr. Fentiman, a small, damp-handed gollywog of a man with a strong faith in lye and leeches. The sight of him made her shudder. No. Thank you, but I'm quite all right. I was just taken queer for a moment. Ah, good. Jocasta turned blind eyes toward Lord John. His lordship will be going on to Wilmington in the morning. He wished to pay you his regards, if you are well enough. Yes, of course. She sat up, swinging her feet to the floor. So the lord wasn't going to linger. That would be a disappointment to Jocasta, if not to her. Still, she could be polite for a little while. Ulysses set down the tray and soft-footed out the door behind her aunt, leaving them alone. He drew up an embroidered footstool and sat down, not waiting for invitation.
Are you truly well, Miss Fraser? I have no desire to see you prostrate among the teacups.
A smile pulled at the corner of his mouth, and she flushed. I'm fine, she said shortly. Did you have something to say to me? He wasn't taken aback by her abruptness.
Yes, but I thought perhaps you would prefer that I not mention it in the midst of the company. I understand that you are interested in the whereabouts of a man named Roger Wakefield.
She had been feeling fine. At this, the wave of faintness threatened to return. Yes. How do you... Do you know where he is?
No.
He saw her face change and took her hand between his.
No, I'm sorry. Your father had written to me some 3 months ago, asking me to assist him in finding this man. It had occurred to him that if Mr. Wakefield was anywhere in the ports, he might have been taken up by a press gang, and thus be now at sea in one of His Majesty's ships. He asked if I would make use of my acquaintance in naval circles to determine whether such a fate had, in fact, befallen Mr. Wakefield.
Another wave of faintness passed over her, this one tinged with remorse, as she realized the lengths her father had gone to in attempting to find Roger for her. He isn't on a ship. He looked surprised at her tone of certainty.
I have found no evidence that he was impressed anywhere between Jamestown and Charleston. Still, there is the possibility that he was taken up on the eve of sailing, in which case his presence on the crew wouldn't be registered until the ship reached port. That is why I travel tomorrow to Wilmington to make inquiries.
You don't need to. I know where he is. In as few words as possible, she acquainted him with the basic facts.
Jamie, your father, that is, your parents, have gone to rescue this man from the Iroquois.
Looking shaken, he turned and poured two cups of tea, handing her one without asking if she wanted it. She held it between her hands, finding a small comfort in the warmth, a greater comfort in being able to speak frankly to Lord John.
Yes,
I wanted to go with them, but...
Yes, I see.
He glanced at her bulge and coughed.
I collect there is some urgency in finding Mr. Wakefield.
She laughed unhappily.
I can wait. Can you tell me something, Lord John? Have you ever heard of hand fasting?
His fair brows drew together momentarily.
Yes,
he said slowly.
A Scottish custom of temporary marriage, is it not?
Yes. What I want to know is it legal here?
He rubbed his jaw, thinking.
Either he'd shaved recently, or he had a light beard. Late as it was, he showed no sign of stubble. I don't know, he said finally. I've never seen the question addressed in law. Still, any couple who dwells together as man and wife are considered married by common law. I should think hand-fasting would fall into that class, would it not?
It might, except that we're rather obviously not dwelling together, Brianna said. She sighed. I think I'm married, but my aunt doesn't. She keeps insisting that Roger won't come back, or that if he does, I'm still not legally bound to him. Even by the Scots custom, I'm not bound beyond a year and a day. She wants to pick a husband for me, and God, she's trying. I thought you were the newest candidate when you showed up.
Lord John looked amused at the idea.
Oh, that would explain the oddly assorted company at dinner. I did notice that the rather florid gentleman,
Alderdice, a judge,
seemed inclined to pay you attention beyond the normal limits of gallantry.
Much good it'll do him,
Brianna snorted briefly. You should have seen the looks Mrs. Alderdice kept giving me all through dinner. She's not going to have her, you lamb. God, he must be 40 if he's a day. Marry the local whore of Babylon. I'd be surprised if she ever lets him set foot over the doorstep again. She patted her small bulge. I think I've seen to that. One brow rose, and Grey smiled wryly at her. He set down his teacup and reached for the sherry decanter and a glass.
Ah, well, while I admire the boldness of your strategy, Miss Fraser, may I call you my dear, I regret to inform you that your tactics do not suit the terrain upon which you've chosen to employ them.
What do you mean by that?
He leaned back in his chair, glass in hand, surveying her kindly.
Mrs. Alderdice, not being blind, though by no means as astute as your aunt, I did indeed observe her observing you. But you mistake the nature of her observations, I'm afraid.
He shook his head, looking at her over the rim of his glass as he sipped.
Not the look of outraged respectability, by any means. It's granny lust.
Brianna sat up straight.
It's what?
Granny lust, he repeated.
He sat up himself and topped his glass, pouring the golden liquid carefully.
You know, an elderly woman's urgent desire for grandchildren to dandle upon her knee, spoil with sweetmeats, and generally corrupt.
He raised his glass to his nose and reverently breathed in the vapours.
Oh, ambrosia. I haven't had a decent sherry in 2 years, at least.
What? You mean Mrs. Alderdice thinks that I mean, because I've shown that I can have children, then she's sure to get grandchildren out of me later on? That's ridiculous. The judge could pick any healthy girl of good character, she added bitterly, and be fairly sure of having children by her.
He took a final drink, let it drift across his tongue, and swallowed, relishing the final ghost of the taste before answering.
Well, no. I rather think that she realizes he could not, or would not. It makes no difference.
He looked at her directly, pale blue eyes unblinking.
You said it yourself. He is 40 and unmarried.
You mean he... But he's a judge!
The moment her horrified exclamation came out, she realized the idiocy of it and clapped a hand over her mouth, blushing furiously. Lord John laughed, though with a wry edge to it.
The more certainty, therefore, he said. You are quite right. He could have his choice of any girl in the county. If he has not so chosen...
He paused delicately, then lifted his glass to her in ironic toast.
I rather think that Mrs. Alderdice has realized that her son's marriage to you is her best, possibly her only, expectation of having the grandchild she so ardently desires.
Damn!
She couldn't make a move right, she thought, with despair. It doesn't matter what I do. I'm doomed. They'll have me married off to somebody, no matter what I do.
You must give me leave to doubt that, he said.
His smile quirked sideways, a little painfully.
From what I've seen of you, you have your mother's bluntness and your father's sense of honour. Either would be sufficient to preserve you from such entrapment.
Don't talk to me about my father's honour, she said sharply. He's who's got me into this mess.
His eyes dropped to her waistline, frankly ironical.
You shock me, he said politely,
seeming not shocked at all. She felt the blood surge up in her face once more, hotter than before.
You know perfectly well that's not what I mean.
He hid a smile in his sherry cup, eyes crinkling at her.
My apologies, Miss Fraser. What did you mean, then?
She took a deep sip of tea to cover her confusion, and felt the comforting heat run down her throat and into her chest.
I mean, she said through her teeth, this particular mess. Being put on show like a piece of bloodstock with doubtful lines. Being held up by the scruff of the neck like an orphan kitten in hopes somebody will take me in. Being left alone here in the first place, she ended, her voice trembling unexpectedly.
Why are you alone here?
Lord John asked quite gently.
I should have thought that your mother might have...
She wanted to. I wouldn't let her. Because she had to. That is, he... Oh, it's all such a fucking mess.
She dropped her head into her hands and stared wretchedly at the tabletop. Not crying, but not far from it either.
I can see that.
Lord John leaned forward and put his empty glass back on the tray.
It's very late, my dear, and if you will pardon my observing it, you are in need of rest.
He stood up and laid a hand lightly on her shoulder. Oddly, it seemed only friendly and not condescending, as another man's might.
As it seems my journey to Wilmington is unnecessary, I think I will accept your aunt's kind invitation to remain here for a little.
We will speak again, and see whether, perhaps, there is at least some palliative for your situation.
Chapter 59 Blackmail.
The commode was magnificent, a beautiful piece of smooth carved walnut that mingled appeal with convenience, particularly convenient on a rainy, cold night like this. She fumbled sleepily with the lid in the dark, lit by lightning flashes from the window, then sat down, sighing with relief as the pressure on her bladder eased. Evidently pleased with the additional internal space thus provided, Osbert performed a series of lazy somersaults, making her belly undulate in ghostly waves beneath her white flannel nightgown. She stood up slowly. She did almost everything slowly these days, feeling pleasantly drugged with sleep. She paused by the rumpled bed. The glass of the window was icy to the touch, and the clouds rolled down from the mountains, black-bellied and growling with thunder. It wasn't snowing, but it was a nasty night, and no mistake. And what was it like in the high mountains now? Had they reached a village that would shelter them? Had they found Roger? She shivered involuntarily, though the embers still glowed red in the hearth, and the room was warm. She felt the irresistible pull of her bed, promising warmth,
and even more, the lure of dreams in which she might escape the chronic nag of fear and guilt. She turned to the door, though, and pulled her cloak from the peg behind it. The urgency of pregnancy might necessitate her using the commode in her room, but she was resolved that no slave would ever carry a chamber pot for her, not as long as she could walk. She wrapped the cloak tightly around her, took the lidded pewter receptacle from its cabinet, and stepped quietly into the corridor. It was very late. All the candles had been put out, and the stale smell of dead fires lay in the stairwell, but she could see clearly enough by the flickering of the lightning as she made her way downstairs. The kitchen door was unbolted, a piece of carelessness for which she blessed the cook. No need to make noise, struggling one-handed with the heavy bolt. Freezing rain struck her face and whooshed up beneath the hem of her nightgown, making her gasp. Once past the first shock of cold, though, she enjoyed it. The violence of it was exhilarating, the wind strong enough to lift her cloak in billowing surges that made her feel light on her feet for the first time in months. She swept in a flurry to the necessary house, rinsed out the pot in the drench of rain that poured from its gutters, then stood in the paved yard, letting the fresh wind sweep into her face and slash her cheeks with rain. She wasn't sure if this was expiation or exaltation, a need to share the discomfort her parents might be facing, or some more pagan rite, a need to lose herself by joining in the ferocity of the elements. Either or both, it didn't matter. She stepped deliberately under the spout of the gutter, letting the water pound against her scalp and soak her hair and shoulders. Gasping and shaking water from her hair like a dog, she stepped back and stopped, her eye caught by a sudden flash of light. Not lightning, a steady beam that shone for a moment, then vanished. A door in the slave quarters opened for a moment, then closed. Was someone coming? Someone was. She could hear footsteps on the gravel, and took another step back into the shadows. The last thing she wanted was to explain what she was doing out here. The lightning showed him clearly as he passed, and she felt a jar of recognition. Lord John Grey, hurrying, shirt-sleeved and bareheaded, his fair hair unbound and blowing in the wind, evidently oblivious to the cold and rain. He passed without seeing her, and vanished under the overhang of the kitchen porch. Realizing that she was in danger of being locked out, she ran after him, awkward but still fast. He was just closing the door when she hit it with her shoulder. She burst into the kitchen and stood dripping, Lord John goggling at her in disbelief. "Nice night for a walk," she said, half breathless. "Isn't it?" She wiped back her wet hair, and with a cordial nod, slipped past him, out and up the stairs, her bare feet leaving wet half-moon prints on the dark polished wood. She listened, but heard no steps behind her as she reached her room. She left cloak and gown spread out before the fire to dry, and having toweled her hair and face, climbed naked into bed. She was shivering, but the feel of the cotton sheets on her bare skin was wonderful. She stretched, wiggling her toes, then rolled on her side, curling tightly around her centre of gravity, letting the constant heat from within tendril outward, gradually reaching her skin, forming a small cocoon of warmth around her. She replayed the scene on the footpath once more in memory. And very gradually, the shadowy thoughts that had been rattling around in her mind for days fell together into a rational shape. Lord John treated her always with attention and respect, often with amusement or admiration. But there was something missing. She hadn't been able to identify it, for some time hadn't even been aware of it. But now she knew what it was, without doubt. She was accustomed, as are most striking women, to the open admiration of men, and this she had from Lord John as well. But below such admiration was usually a deeper awareness, more subtle than glance or gesture. A vibration like the distant chime of a bell, a visceral acknowledgement of herself as female. She had thought she felt it from Lord John when they met,
but it had been gone on subsequent meetings, and she had concluded that she had mistaken it at first. She should have guessed before, she thought. She'd encountered that inner indifference once before in the roommate of a casual boyfriend. But then Lord John hid it very well. She might never have guessed were it not for that chance encounter in the yard. No, he didn't chime for her. But when he came out of the servants' quarters, he had been ringing like a fire bell. She wondered briefly if her father knew, but dismissed the possibility. After his experiences in Wentworth Prison, he couldn't possibly hold a man with that preference in such warm regard as she knew he felt for Lord John. She rolled onto her back. The polished cotton of the sheet slid across the bare skin of breasts and thighs, caressing. She half noticed the feeling, and as her nipple hardened, she raised a hand to cup her breast in reflex, felt Roger's large, warm hand in memory, and a sudden surge of wanting. Then, in memory, she felt the sudden grasp of rougher hands, pinching and mauling, and wanting changed at once to sickened fury. She flipped onto her stomach, arms crossed beneath her breasts, and face buried in her pillow, legs clenched and teeth gritted in futile defence. The baby was a large, uncomfortable lump, impossible to lie that way now. With a small, half-spoken curse, she rolled over and jerked out of bed, out from under the betraying, seductive sheets. She walked naked through the half-lit room and stood again by the window, looking out at the pounding rain. Her hair hung damp down her back, and cold was coming through the glass, pebbling the white flesh of arms and thighs and belly. She made no move either to cover herself or to go back to bed, but only stood there, one hand on the gently squirming bulge, looking out. It would be too late soon. She had known when they left that it was already too late. So had her mother. Neither of them had wanted to admit it to the other, though. They had both pretended that Roger would come back in time, that he and she would sail to Hispaniola and find their way back through the stones, together. She laid her other hand against the glass. At once a mist of condensation sprang up, outlining her fingers. It was early March, maybe 3 months left, maybe less. It would take a week, maybe two, to travel to the coast. No ship would risk the treacherous Outer Banks in March, though. Early April at the soonest, before a journey could be undertaken. How long to the West Indies? 2 weeks? Three? The end of April, then. And a few days to make their way inland, find the cave. It would be slow fighting through the jungle, more than 8 months pregnant. And dangerous. Though that didn't matter much, considering. That would be if Roger were here now. But he wasn't. He might never come, though that was a possibility she fought hard against envisioning. If she didn't think about all the ways he could die, then he wouldn't die. It was one article of her stubborn faith. The others were that he wasn't dead yet, and that her mother would come back before the child was born. As to her father, rage boiled up again as it did whenever she thought of him. Him or Bonnet. So she tried to think of either of them as little as possible. She prayed, of course, as hard as she could. But she wasn't constituted for praying and waiting. She was made for action. If only she could have gone with them to find Roger. She hadn't had a choice about that, though. Her jaw tightened and her hand splayed flat against her belly. She hadn't made a choice about a lot of things. But she had made one choice, to keep her child, and now she'd have to live with the consequences of it. She was beginning to shiver. Abruptly, she turned away from the storm and went to the fire. A small tongue of flame played along the blackened back of a red crackled log, the heart of the embers glowing gold and white. She sank down on the hearthrug, closing her eyes as the heat of the fire sent waves of comfort over her cold skin, caressing as the stroke of a hand. This time she kept all thought of Bonnet at bay,
refusing him entrance to her mind, concentrating fiercely instead on the few precious memories she had of Roger.
"Put your hand on my heart. Tell me if it stops."
She could hear him, half breathless, half choked between laughter and passion.
"How the hell do you know that?"
The rough feel of curly hairs under her palms, the smooth, hard curves of his shoulders, the throb of the pulse in the side of his throat when she'd pulled him down to her and put her mouth on him, wanting in her urgency to bite him, to taste him, to breathe the salt and dust of his skin. The dark and secret places of him that she knew only by feel recalled a soft weight rolling and vulnerable in her palm, a complexity of curve and depth that yielded reluctantly to her probing fingertips.
"Oh, God, don't stop, but careful, I. Oh."
The strange wrinkled silk that grew taut and smooth filled her hand, rising, silent and incredible as the stalk of a night-blooming flower that opens as you watch.
His gentleness as he touched her. "Christ, I wish I could see your face, to know how it is for you. Am I doing well by you? Is it good, just there? Tell me, Bree, talk to me."
As she explored him, and then the moment when she had pushed him too far, her mouth on his nipple. She felt again the sudden amazing surge of power in him as he lost all sense of restraint and seized her, lifting her as though she weighed nothing, rolled her back against the straw and took her, half hesitating as he remembered her freshly riven flesh, then answering the demand of her nails in his back to come to her fiercely, forcing her past the fear of impalement into acceptance and welcome, and finally into a frenzy that matched his own, rupturing the last membrane of reticence between them, joining them forever in a flood of sweat and musk and blood and semen. She moaned out loud, shuddered, and lay still, too weak even to move her hand away. Her heart was thumping very slowly. Her belly was tight as a drum, the last of the spasms slowly relaxing its grip on her swollen womb. One half of her body blazed with heat, the other was cool and dark. After a moment, she rolled onto her hands and knees and crawled away from the fire. She hauled herself onto the bed like a wounded beast and lay half stunned, ignoring the currents of heat and cold that played over her. At last she stirred, pulled a single quilt over her, and lay staring at the wall, hands crossed in protection over her baby. Yes, it was too late. Sensation and yearning must be put aside, along with love and anger. She must resist the mindless pull of both body and emotion. There were decisions to be made. It took 3 days to convince herself of the virtue of her plan, to overcome her own scruples, and at last to find a suitable time and place in which to catch him alone. But she was thorough, and she was patient. She had all the time in the world, nearly 3 months of it. On Tuesday, her opportunity came at last. Jocasta was closeted in her study with Duncan Innes and the account books. Ulysses, with a brief inscrutable look at the closed door of the study, had gone to the kitchen to superintend the preparations for yet another lavish dinner in his lordship's honour, and she had gotten rid of Fevre by sending her on horseback to Barra Meadows to fetch a book Jenny Ban Campbell had promised her. With a fresh blue camlet gown that matched her eyes, and a heart beating in her chest like a trip hammer, she set out to stalk her victim. She found him in the library, reading the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius by the French windows, the morning sun streaming over his shoulder, making his smooth, fair hair gleam like buttered toffee. He looked up from his book when she came in. A hippopotamus could have made a more graceful entrance, she thought, crossly, catching her skirt on a corner of the bric-a-brac table in her nervousness. Then graciously laid it aside, springing to his feet to bow over her hand.
No, I don't want to sit down, thank you.
She shook her head at the seat he was offering her.
I wondered... That is, I thought I'd go for a walk. Would you like to come with me?
There was frost on the lower panes of the French door, a stiff breeze whining past the house, and soft chairs, brandy, and blazing fire within. But Lord John was a gentleman.
There is nothing I should like better, he gallantly assured her, and abandoned Marcus Aurelius without a backward glance.
It was a bright day, but very cold. Muffled in thick cloaks, they turned into the kitchen garden, where the high walls gave them some shelter from the wind. They exchanged small, breathless comments on the brightness of the day, assured each other that they weren't cold at all, and came through a small archway into the brick-walled herbary. Brianna glanced around them. They were quite alone, and she would be able to see anyone coming along the walk. Best not waste time, then.
"I have a proposal to make to you," she said.
"I am sure any notion of yours must necessarily be delightful, my dear," he said, smiling slightly.
"Well, I don't know about that," she said, and took a deep breath. "But here goes. I want you to marry me."
He kept smiling, evidently waiting for the punchline.
"I mean it," she said.
The smile didn't altogether go away, but it altered. She wasn't sure whether he was dismayed at her gaucherie or just trying not to laugh, but she suspected the latter.
"I don't want any of your money," she assured him. "I'll sign a paper saying so. And you don't need to live with me either, though it's probably a good idea for me to go to Virginia with you, at least for a little while. As for what I could do for you..."
She hesitated, knowing that hers was the weaker side of the bargain.
"I'm strong, but that doesn't mean much to you since you have servants. I'm a good manager, though. I can keep accounts, and I think I know how to run a farm. I do know how to build things. I could manage your property in Virginia while you were in England, and... You have a young son, don't you? I'll look after him. I'd be a good mother to him."
Lord John had stopped dead in the path during this speech. Now he leaned slowly back against the brick wall, casting his eyes up in a silent prayer for understanding.
"Dear God in heaven," he said, "that I should live to hear an offer like that."
Then he lowered his head and gave her a direct and piercing look.
"Are you out of your mind?"
"No," she said, with an attempt at keeping her own composure. "It's a perfectly reasonable suggestion."
"I have heard," he said, rather cautiously, with an eye to her belly, "that women in an expectant condition are somewhat excitable in consequence of their state. I confess, though, that my experience is distressingly limited with respect to... That is,
perhaps I should send for Dr. Fentiman."
She drew herself up to her full height, put a hand on the wall and leaned toward him, deliberately looking down on him, menacing him with her sighs.
"No, you should not," she said in measured tones. "Listen to me, Lord John. I'm not crazy, I'm not frivolous, and I don't mean it to be an inconvenience to you in any way. But I'm dead serious."
The cold had reddened his fair skin, and there was a drop of moisture glistening on the tip of his nose. He wiped it on a fold of his cloak, eyeing her with something between interest and horror. At least he'd stop laughing. She felt mildly sick, but she'd have to do it. She'd hoped it could be avoided, but there seemed no other way.
"If you don't agree to marry me," she said, "I'll expose you."
"You'll do what?"
His usual mask of urbanity had disappeared, leaving puzzlement and the beginnings of wariness in its stead. She was wearing woolen mittens, but her fingers felt frozen. So did everything else, except the warm lump of her slumbering child.
"I know what you were doing the other night at the slave quarters. I'll tell everyone. My aunt, Mr. Campbell, the sheriff, "I'll write letters," she said, her lips feeling numb even as she uttered the ridiculous threat. "To the governor and the governor of Virginia. They put pederasts in the pillory here. Mr. Campbell told me so."
A frown drew his brows together. They were so fair that they scarcely showed against his skin when he stood in strong light.
They reminded her of Lizzie's.
"Stop looming over me, if you please."
He took hold of her wrist and pulled it down with a force that surprised her. He was small, but much stronger than she had supposed, and for the first time she was slightly afraid of what she was doing. He took her firmly by the elbow and propelled her into motion away from the house. The thought struck her that perhaps he meant to take her down to the river out of sight and try to drown her. She thought it unlikely, but still resisted the direction of his urging, and turned back into the square-laid paths of the kitchen garden instead. He made no demur, but went with her, though it meant walking head-on into the wind. He didn't speak until they had turned once more and reached a sheltered corner by the onion bed.
"I'm halfway tempted to submit to your outrageous proposal," he said at last,
the corner of his mouth twitching, whether with fury or amusement she couldn't tell.
"It would certainly please your aunt. It would outrage your mother. And it would teach you to play with fire, I do assure you."
She caught a gleam in his eye that gave her a sudden surge of doubt about her conclusions as to his preferences. She drew back from him a bit.
"Oh, I hadn't thought of that, that you might... men and women both, I mean."
"I was married,"
he pointed out with some sarcasm.
"Yes, but I thought that was probably the same kind of thing I'm suggesting now. Just a formal arrangement, I mean. That's what made me think of it in the first place, once I realized that you..."
She broke off with an impatient gesture.
"Are you telling me that you do like to go to bed with women?"
He raised one eyebrow.
"Would that make a substantial difference to your plans?"
"Well," she said uncertainly, "yes. Yes, it would. If I'd known that, I wouldn't have suggested it."
"Suggest it, she says," he muttered. "Public denunciation, the pillory, suggested."
The blood burned so hotly in her cheeks, she was surprised not to see the cold air turn to steam around her face.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I wouldn't have done it. You have to believe me. I really wouldn't have said a word to anybody. It's only when you laughed I thought... anyway, it doesn't matter. If you did want to sleep with me, I couldn't marry you. It wouldn't be right."
He closed his eyes very tight and held them squinched shut for a minute. Then he opened one light blue eye and looked at her.
"Why not?" he asked.
"Because of Roger," she said,
and was infuriated to hear her voice break on the name. Still more infuriated to feel a hot tear escape to run down her cheek.
"Damn it," she said. "Damn it to hell. I wasn't even going to think about him."
She swiped the tear angrily away and clenched her teeth.
"Maybe you're right," she said. "Maybe it's being pregnant. I cry all the time over nothing."
"I rather doubt it is nothing,"
he said dryly. She took a deep breath, the cold air hollowing her chest. There was one last card to play, then.
"If you do like women, I couldn't... I mean, I don't want to sleep with you regularly. And I wouldn't mind your sleeping with anybody else, male or female."
"Thank you for that," he muttered.
But she ignored him, bent only on the need to get it all out.
"But I can see that you might want a child of your own. It wouldn't be right for me to keep you from having one. I can give you that, I think."
She glanced down at herself, arms clasped across the round of her belly.
"Everyone says I'm made for childbearing," she went on steadily, eyes on her feet. "Just until I got pregnant again, though. You'd have to put that in the contract, too. Mr. Campbell could draw it up."
Lord John massaged his forehead, evidently suffering the onslaught of a massive headache.
Then he dropped his hand and took her by the arm.
"Come and sit down, child,"
he said quietly.
"You'd best tell me what the devil you're up to."
She took a deep, savage breath to steady her voice.
"I'm not a child," she said.
He glanced up at her and seemed to change his mind about something.
"No, you're not. God help us both. But before you startle Farquhar Campbell into an apoplexy with your notion of a suitable marriage contract, I beg you to sit with me for a moment and share the processes of your most remarkable brain."
He motioned her through the archway into the ornamental garden, where they would be invisible from the house. The garden was bleak but orderly. All the dead stalks of the year before had been pulled out, the dry stems chopped and scattered as mulch over the beds. Only in the circular bed around the dry fountain were there signs of life. Green crocus spikes poked up like tiny battering rams, vivid and intransigent. They sat, but she couldn't sit. Not and face him. He got up with her and walked beside her, not touching her but keeping pace, the wind whipping strands of blonde hair across his face, not saying a word, but listening, listening, as she told him almost everything. "So I've been thinking and thinking," she ended wretchedly, "and I never get anywhere. Do you see? Mother and Da, they're out there somewhere." She waved an arm toward the distant mountains. Anything could happen to them. Anything might have happened to Roger already. "And here I sit, getting bigger and bigger, and there's nothing I can do." She glanced down at him and drew the back of a mittened hand under her dripping nose. "I'm not crying," she assured him, though she was.
"Of course not," he said.
He took her hand and drew it through his arm.
"Round and round," he murmured,
eyes on the path of crazy paving as they circled the fountain. "Yes, round and round the mulberry bush," she agreed, "and it'll be pop goes the weasel in 3 months or so." "I have to do something," she ended miserably.
"Believe it or not, in your case, waiting is doing something, though I admit it may not seem so,"
he answered dryly.
"Why is it that you will not wait to see whether your father's quest is successful? Is it that your sense of honour will not allow you to bear a fatherless child, or—"
"It's not my honour," she said. "It's his. Roger's. He's—" "He followed me. He gave up everything and came after me when I came here to find my father. I knew he would, and he did. When he finds out about this—" she grimaced, cupping a hand to the swell of her stomach. "He'll marry me. He'll feel as though he has to, and I can't let him do that."
"Why not?"
"Because I love him. I don't want him to marry me out of obligation, and I—" She clamped her lips tight on the rest of it. "I won't," she ended firmly. "I've made up my mind, and I won't." Lord John pulled his cloak tighter as a fresh blast of wind came rocketing in off the river. It smelled of ice and dead leaves, but there was a hint of freshness in it. Spring was coming.
"I see," he said. "Well, I quite agree with your aunt that you require a husband. Why me, though?"
He raised one pale brow.
"Is it my title or my wealth?"
"Neither one. It was because I was sure that you didn't like women," she said, giving him one of those candid blue looks.
"I do like women," he said, exasperated. "I admire and honour them, and for several of the sex I feel considerable affection. Your mother among them, though I doubt the sentiment is reciprocated. I do not, however, seek pleasure in their beds. Do I speak plainly enough?"
"Yes," she said, the small lines between her eyes vanishing like magic. "That's what I thought. See, it wouldn't be right for me to marry Mr. McNeil or Barton McLaughlin or any of those men, because I'd be promising something I couldn't give them. But you don't want that anyway, so there isn't any reason why I can't marry you."
He repressed a strong urge to bang his head against the wall.
There most assuredly is.
What?
To name only the most obvious, your father would undoubtedly break my neck.
What for? She demanded, frowning. He likes you. He says you're one of his best friends.
I am honoured to be the recipient of his esteem, he said shortly. However, that esteem would very shortly cease to exist upon Jamie Fraser's discovering that his daughter was serving as consort and brood mare to a degenerate sodomite.
And how would he discover that? She demanded. I wouldn't tell him. Then she flushed, and meeting his outraged eyes, suddenly dissolved into laughter, in which he helplessly joined. Well, I'm sorry, but you said it, she gasped at last, sitting up and wiping her streaming eyes with the hem of her cloak.
Oh, Christ, yes, I did.
Distracted, he thumbed a strand of hair out of his mouth and wiped his running nose on his sleeve again.
Damn, why haven't I a handkerchief? I said it because it's true. As for your father finding out, he's well aware of the fact.
He is? She seemed disproportionately surprised. But I thought he'd never... A flash of yellow apron interrupted her. One of the kitchen maids was in the adjoining garden. Without comment, Lord John stood up and gave her a hand. She got ponderously to her feet, and they sailed out onto the dry brown scurf of the dead lawn, cloaks billowing like sails around them. The stone bench under the willow tree was devoid of its usual charm at this time of year, but it was at least sheltered from the icy blasts off the river. Lord John saw her seated, sat down himself, and sneezed explosively. She opened her cloak and dug in the bosom of her dress, finally coming out with a crumpled handkerchief, which she handed to him with apologies. It was warm and smelled of her, a disconcerting odour of girl flesh spiced with cloves and lavender.
"What you said about teaching me to play with fire," she said. "Just what did you mean by that?"
"Nothing," he said.
But now it was his turn to flush.
"Nothing, hmm?"
she said, and gave him the ghost of an ironic smile.
"That was a threat, if I ever heard one."
He sighed and wiped his face once more with her handkerchief.
"You've been frank with me," he said, "to the point of embarrassment and well beyond. So, yes, I suppose I... No, it was a threat."
He made a small gesture of surrender.
"You look like your father, don't you see?"
She frowned at him, his words obviously meaning nothing. Then realization flickered, sprang to full life. She sat bolt upright, staring down at him.
"Not you. Not Da. He wouldn't."
"No," Lord John said very dryly. "He wouldn't. Though your shock is scarcely flattering. And for what the statement is worth, I would under no circumstances take advantage of your likeness to him." That was as much an idle threat as was your menacing me with exposure.
"Where did you meet my father?" she asked carefully,
her own troubles superseded for the moment by curiosity.
"In prison. You knew he was imprisoned after the rising."
She nodded, frowning slightly.
"Yes, well, leave it as said that I harbour feelings of particular affection for Jamie Fraser and have for some years."
He shook his head, sighing.
"And here you come, offering me your innocent body with its echoes of his flesh. And add to that the promise of giving me a child who would mingle my blood with his. And all this, because your honour will not let you wed a man you love, or love a man you wed."
He broke off and sank his head in his hands.
"Child, you would make an angel weep. God knows I'm no angel."
"My mother thinks you are."
He glanced up at her, startled.
"She thinks what?"
"Maybe she wouldn't go quite that far," she amended, still frowning. "She says you're a good man, though. I think she likes you." but she doesn't want to. Of course, I understand that now. I suppose she must know how you, feel about...
She coughed, hiding her blushes in a fold of her cloak.
Hell, he muttered. Oh, hell and thundering damnation. I ought never to have come out with you. Yes, she does. Though in all truth I'm not sure why she regards me with suspicion. Cannot be jealousy, surely.
Brianna shook her head, chewing thoughtfully on her lower lip. I think it's because she's afraid you'll hurt him somehow. She's afraid for him, you know. He glanced up at her, startled.
Hurt him? How? Does she think I will overpower him and commit depraved indignities upon his person?
He spoke lightly, but a flicker in her eyes froze the words in his throat. He tightened his grip on her arm. She bit her lip, then gently detached his hand, laying it on his knee.
Have you ever seen my father with his shirt off?
Do you mean the scars on his back?
She nodded. He drummed his fingers restlessly on his knees, soundless on the fine broadcloth.
Yes, I've seen them. I did that.
Her head jerked back, eyes wide. The end of her nose was cherry red, but the rest of her skin so pale that her hair and eyebrows seemed to have leached all the life from it.
Not all of it,
he said, staring off into a bed of dead hollyhocks.
He'd been flogged before, which made it all the worse. That he knew what he was doing when he did it.
Did what? She asked.
Slowly she rearranged herself on the bench, not so much turning toward him as flowing in her garments, like a cloud changing shape in the wind.
I was the commander at Ardsmuir Prison. Did he tell you? No, I thought not.
He made an impatient gesture, brushing back the strands of fair hair that whipped across his face.
He was an officer, a gentleman, the only officer there. He spoke for the Jacobite prisoners. We dined together in my quarters. We played chess. We spoke of books. We had interests in common. We became friends. And then we were not.
He stopped speaking. She drew away from him a bit, distaste in her eyes.
You mean you had him flogged because he wouldn't?
No, damn it, I did not.
He snatched the handkerchief and scrubbed angrily at his nose. He flung it down on the seat between them and glared at her.
How dare you suggest such a thing?
But you said it yourself, you did it.
He did it.
You can't flog yourself.
He started to reply, then snorted. He raised one brow at her, still angry, but with his feelings coming back under control.
The hell you can't. You've been doing it for months, according to what you've told me.
We aren't talking about me.
Of course we are.
No, we're not.
She leaned toward him, heavy brows drawn down.
What the hell do you mean? He did it.
The wind was blowing from behind her into his face. It made his eyes sting and water, and he looked away.
What am I doing here? He muttered to himself. I must be mad to be talking with you in this manner.
I don't care if you're mad or not, she said, and gripped him by the sleeve. You tell me what happened.
He pressed his lips tight together, and for a moment she thought he wouldn't. But he'd already said too much to stop, and he knew it. His shoulders rose under his cloak and dropped, slumping in surrender.
We were friends. Then he discovered my feeling for him. We were no longer friends by his choice. But that wasn't enough for him. He wished a final severance. And so he deliberately brought about an occasion so drastic that it must alter our relation irrevocably and prevent any chance of friendship between us. So he lied. During a search of the prisoner's quarters, he claimed a piece of tartan publicly as his own. Possession was against the law then. It still is in Scotland.
He drew a deep breath and let it out. He wouldn't look at her, but kept his eyes focused on the ragged fringe of bare trees across the river, raw against the pale spring sky.
I was the governor, charged with the execution of the law. I was obliged to have him flogged, as he damn well knew I would be.
He tilted his head back, resting it against the carved stone back of the bench. His eyes were closed against the wind.
I could forgive his not wanting me, he said, with quiet bitterness. But I couldn't forgive him for making me use him in that fashion, not forcing me merely to hurt him, but to degrade him. He couldn't merely refuse to acknowledge my feeling. He must destroy it. It was too much.
Bits of debris boiled past on the flood. Storm-cracked twigs and branches. A broken board from the hull of a boat, wrecked somewhere upstream. Her hand covered his where it rested on his knee. It was slightly larger than his own, and warm from sheltering in her cloak. There was a reason. It wasn't you. But it's for him to tell you if he wants to. You did forgive him, though, she said quietly. Why? He sat up then and shrugged, but didn't put away her hand.
I had to.
He glanced at her, eyes straight and level.
I hated him for as long as I could. But then I realized that loving him, that was part of me and one of the best parts. It didn't matter that he couldn't love me. That had nothing to do with it. But if I could not forgive him, then I couldn't love him, and that part of me was gone. And I found eventually that I wanted it back.
He smiled faintly.
So you see, it was really entirely selfish.
He squeezed her hand then, stood up, and pulled her to her feet.
Come, my dear. We shall both freeze solid if we sit here any longer.
They walked back toward the house, not talking, but walking close together, arm in arm. As they came back through the gardens, he spoke abruptly.
You're right, I think. To live with someone you love, knowing that they tolerate the relation only for the sake of obligation. No, I wouldn't do it either. Were it only a matter of convenience and respect on both sides, then yes. Such a marriage is one of honour. As long as both parties are honest.
His mouth twisted briefly as he glanced in the direction of the servants' quarters.
There is no need for shame on either side.
She looked down at him, brushing a strand of wind-blown copper hair out of her eyes with her free hand. Then you'll accept my proposal. The hollow feeling in her chest didn't feel like the relief she had expected.
No, he said bluntly. I may have forgiven Jamie Fraser for what he did in the past, but he would never forgive me for marrying you.
He smiled at her and patted the hand he held tucked in the curve of his arm.
I can give you some respite from both your suitors and your aunt, though.
He glanced at the house, whose curtains hung unstirring against the glass.
Do you suppose anyone's watching?
I'd say you can bet on it, she said, a little grimly.
Good.
Pulling off the sapphire ring he wore, he turned to face her and took her hand. He pulled off her mitten and ceremoniously slid the ring onto her little finger, the only one it would fit. Then he rose smoothly on his toes and kissed her on the lips. Leaving her no time to recover from surprise, he clasped her hand in his and turned once more toward the house, his expression bland.
"Come along, my dear," he said. "Let us announce our engagement."
Chapter 60. Trial by Fire. They were left alone all day. The fire was dead, and there was no food left. It didn't matter. Neither man could eat, and no fire would have reached Roger's soul-deep chill. The Indians came back in late afternoon, several warriors escorting an elderly man dressed in a flowing lace shirt and a woven mantle, his face painted with red and ochre. The sachem, bearing a small clay pot in his hands, filled with black liquid. Alexandre had put on his clothes. He stood when the sachem approached him, but neither spoke nor moved. The sachem began to sing in a